Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schoeneman from Juranov with another edition of the ESI Bytes show, and I'm real pleased with today's show. We've got a real pioneer in the field on the show, Jim Daly, who's practiced at a number of influential firms in eDiscovery. Currently is the managing partner of Daly Crowley, based in Kansas City. You were one of the original members of Sedona Conference, Jim?
I was, one of the first 35 back in, I believe, October of 2002.
That's correct, and Jim's also a founder and partner of Intelligent Document Review, Inc., based in Kansas City, and has about a nine-page bio here. Jim, we're going to have an addendum show to this where I'm just going to read your bio, okay? All of it focused on electronic discovery. Has helped me with a number of other past projects, board games on electronic discovery, et cetera. And, hey, I'm happy to have you on the show, Jim. And today we're going to talk about navigating international electronic discovery. So before we start with that, why don't you tell me how you got started in the field of electronic discovery?
Carl, it's great to be here and visit with you. I got involved in electronic discovery probably about the time you did, which is the mid-1990s, when the first wave of electronic discovery came into play in various class action lawsuits around the country, first involving the tobacco industry, then pharmaceutical industry, and so on and so forth. And obviously that revealed a big need on the part of organizations to look at records retention, legal hold notices, to help enforce records retention for relevant documents, as well as the collection, processing, and review of documents for production in litigation and regulatory investigations.
Okay, and today we're talking about sort of a subsection of that area, international issues, which is really specialized. When did you become interested in that area?
Actually, it was in about 1998 that I had my first exposure to cross-border international e-discovery. When I had to go over to Germany, France, and Switzerland and get certain information off large databases that was relevant to certain litigation in the United States. The federal judges involved in that litigation did not accept as a defense to discovery that there were things like EU privacy regulations or blocking statutes that made it difficult. Instead, they said, well, the lawsuit's in the United States. You've got an obligation to bring that relevant evidence back over here. You can't avoid that responsibility. So my client dispatched me with the court's blessing to work with the various data privacy commissioners in those countries to try to find a way to gather the information that was relevant, to remove any personal information from it, and to bring it back to the United States. It was quite an adventure working in three different countries with three different flavors of data protection regulations. Because as you know, the European Union back in 1995 passed what's called the Data Protection Directive that simply requires all EU member states to have some level of data protection and privacy. And then every country within the European Union can pass their own law that meets that standard but can also exceed that standard. And of course, some of those countries like France and Germany and Switzerland in various areas do exceed the minimum standards. You have to work closely with the with not only your client but the governmental officials to make that happen.
Do each of these countries, like I would imagine oftentimes you're in a multi-jurisdiction situation between a couple European countries or other jurisdictions. When you're in Europe, for example, do the countries tend to work well with each other, you know, so that you can group an issue together, or is it really individual one-off regulators that you got to deal with?
Carl, great question. They are really very autonomous, and they jealously guard their jurisdiction. So unlike kind of the criminal investigation and sharing information relating to terrorism, where they have begun to play better together. When it comes to civil discovery and sharing of information just for civil lawsuits or regulatory inquiries, they really are islands unto themselves.
Well, what types of problems or penalties can you run into when you're working in this area?
You know, there are criminal as well as civil penalties for violating various European and truly any international data protection privacy regulations. It should be said that it's not just the European Union, although that's been probably the area of my primary focus over the last decade, but it's increasingly countries in South America, Australia, Canada, Japan, and even China with respect to state secrets, where these issues are now coming into play. So it's not just a bilateral issue, but truly a transnational issue. Some of the problems and penalties include, for instance, the potential for debarment of your client if they are a company, a multinational company, from doing business in that country if they violate consistently data protection or privacy regulations. There are civil penalties and fines as well that can be levied. One recently publicized case last year involved a French attorney who was simply trying to interview a potential witness for a U.S. federal court case. And that individual was prosecuted under the French blocking statute, which prohibits any sort of information gathering for any judicial or administrative proceeding outside the country. He was found guilty, and he was fined 10,000 euros, or about $15,000 U.S., and is facing disbarment as a French advocat as a result. So that case decision kind of illustrates what some of the penalties can be and how they can really touch the individual practitioner.
Yeah, I was going to suggest that it sounds like you almost have to get local counsel involved, but even with local counsel, this is a touchy area.
That is. The best practice, obviously, is involving local counsel, trying to do what you can by way of diplomacy, almost, in terms of finding a way forward on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, we are between a rock and a hard place here because the U.S. discovery requirements are directly in conflict with the EU and other countries' data protection and privacy statutes that prohibit the processing and transfer of information except for specific authorized reasons. And this is not one of those authorized reasons, unfortunately. And they also, U.S. discovery laws also conflict with what we call blocking statutes, which are those broader prohibitions against any kind of information gathering and certainly any kind of discovery of information within a country for its use outside that country.
Sounds like there's some interesting jurisdictional issues here. Are there any interesting decisions that you could point to that involve foreign electronically stored information?
Well, yes. In addition to that most recent decision of the French Supreme Court affirming the conviction of that French attorney with respect to the blocking statute, there's a series of cases in the U.S., even including the U.S. Supreme Court in the Aerospatiale decision, which hold that from the U.S. court's perspective, doing business in the U.S. subjects you to jurisdiction in the U.S., and that includes procedural requirements for discovery and e-discovery. So using that as the litmus test, a most recent case that probably a lot of the listeners have heard about, Columbia Pictures versus Bunnell, involved movement of certain servers from the U.S. over to the Netherlands, and there was some suggestion that that movement of servers to store information about downloads of copyrighted material, allegedly, was in an attempt to avoid jurisdiction of the United States courts in terms of discovery. The courts really were quite adamant in stating that in that instance and in similar instances, simply moving servers or information to another country does not mean that you have a defense to production of that information in the U.S. court system. In that case, as in many other cases, the Aeroespacial case being one in particular, the court said that, number one, it had to be produced in the United States if it was relevant. Number two, the existence of a data privacy or a data protection regulation in another country is no defense to non-production. And number three, that a blocking statute in another country is also no defense. Of course, at the time of those decisions, which both came down before this recent French Supreme Court decision, the U.S. courts took the stance that no country in the right mind would ever enforce a blocking statute or these data privacy regulations in the context of cross-border discovery. Now, since that has happened, it really sets the stage for U.S. courts to revisit this issue in a big way.
Yeah, it seems you're dealing with another legal system trying to dictate. Was that the Bush Doctrine?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was speaking at a seminar in Brussels at the European Commission last October, and I had the pleasure of hearing a rather prominent judge from the United States have a dialogue with the German Data Protection Commissioner. And it really came down to a philosophical debate as to which system of justice was going to be followed and which system of justice more accurately protected the interests of the individual versus the interests of the organization. So it really gets down to a fundamental an almost religious debate as to what are the relative rights and privileges as a private citizen in terms of private personal information versus the commercial interest in protecting the assets, both proactively and defensively, of a company.
Jim, if you can distill down sort of the basic principle or hoop that you might have to jump through, and you've got the interest of protecting privacy of the individual in a foreign country versus the interest of full discovery here in the U.S., what do you have to do to get the data if you're in a tough regulatory sort of battle? What's sort of the, if you can distill down sort of a common principle? Because at some point you get access to the data. Does it have to stay in that country? What safeguards?
Well, the most fundamental principle at stake here is the belief outside the U.S. that a person has a fundamental human right to privacy. So it's not considered a penumbral right as it is sometimes in the U.S., but it's a fundamental human right to privacy and more specifically data privacy. And you can understand a little bit more why that is when you think of how personal information, private information, was abused by the Gestapo in Germany, Nazi Germany, and by the Stasi in East Germany, and in other regimes. And so there's this fervor that is the basis for the EU Privacy Directive and indeed similar privacy directives around the world. Now, all of these directives have certain principles in common, and really there are two pillars. One is restrictions on the processing of personal information, and secondly, on the transfer of personal information. Now, in order to understand this, you've got to realize that personal information under these schemes is any information that identifies an individual. So even a person's name in a to or from or CC column of an email is enough to make that personal information. So it's a very broad definition. It's not limited to credit card information or health information as it is in the U.S. that takes more of a sectoral approach based on HIPAA, FACTA, and other specific statutes. Instead, it's a global right of privacy that extends to any information that can either identify an individual or be used to identify that individual. The second kind of semantic difference is that processing in the context of data privacy regulations really is any kind of touching of the data whatsoever. Accessing it, looking at it, segregating it, archiving it, certainly any attempts to collect, process, cull, review, or produce it. So back to the two main pillars, processing and transfer. Under these regulations, you can't do anything with respect to personal data unless you have a specific regulatory right to do so. There are certain exceptions that allow for an employer, for example, to process or touch the data. And they're quite frankly limited to specific ones enumerated in the regulations that are the common sense ones you might think of. Times when employers need to access personal information for the purpose of, say, cutting paychecks or administering health benefits or administering pension benefits, where it can be said without equivocation that the need to process is directly related to a benefit given to the employee and from which their consent can be inferred. And the only other time you can process information is when you have clear and unambiguous consent of the person whose data is being processed. So it's called the data owner. If I create an email or have in my possession an email that identifies me, then with respect to that email, I have certain substantive rights. I have a right that, number one, it's not going to be processed without my clear consent, and then it will only be handled for the specific purpose for which I've given consent. There will be no onward transfer, no alteration. It will be destroyed or returned when it's no longer needed. I have a right to know where it's located. I have a right to rescind my consent at any time. And probably most importantly, my consent has to be totally free and voluntary. Now, some countries like France have said that employees are not able to give free and voluntary consent ever because they're in an unequal bargaining position. So, in certain countries, even consent doesn't give you that right to process the data. And so you have to be very, very careful about potential violations of these data protection and privacy regulations. And then these risks compound dramatically when you talk about taking the information out of the country and particularly moving it to the U.S., which is a country that has been deemed not to have sufficient safeguards for data protection and privacy. And even where there are some kind of agreements between the U.S. and the EU, for instance, the Safe Harbor Agreement administered by the U.S. Department of Commerce, that only protects in what would I call a business-to-business transfer of information, where there is, for instance, a parent and a subsidiary on both sides of the Atlantic, for example, and they want to share information relating to business operations. Then, in that regard, the safe harbor certification that, in effect, requires the company to abide by those principles that I talked about earlier, or model contract clauses that have been pre-approved by the European Commission, or in some cases, binding corporate rules, which are very timely and costly to try to put into place because you have to get them approved by each and every member state of the European Union. I think there are only two companies that have even done that, even in part. Those are the various mechanisms that can be used, again, for business-to-business sharing of personal information, but not so in the context of litigation. And that's where this big catch-22 comes into play, where, you're darned if you do, you're darned if you don't. You just have to decide, as a matter of risk management, number one, what can I do to mitigate the risk? And number two, where am I going to take the biggest risk? Is it going to be in the U.S. and risk sanctions for failure to provide adequate discovery, or am I going to face criminal and civil prosecution outside the U.S. under a data privacy protection regulation or a blocking statute?
Maybe you find a French lawyer who will take the fall for you for. Anyway, well, that sounds like a lot of hoops. You may or may not get the data, and you just have to be very careful and assess the risks. Law's only part of the piece of the puzzle. You know, when you're dealing with foreign electronically stored information in a electronic discovery context, you then got to look at the stuff, review it, and understand it. Are there any other complexities with the review itself that you'd like to shed some light on?
Well, there are, and I should mention that there are initiatives going forward through the Sedona Conference, the Working Group 6 that I chair, dealing with international electronic records, retention, production, and data privacy, as well as other groups, to try to harmonize the very legitimate interests that non-U.S. countries have in data privacy and protection with the also legitimate interests of protecting corporate rights and obligations. So there are certain efforts. In fact, the Sedona Conference is having a seminar in June of this year in Barcelona dealing specifically with those issues, and many of the data protection commissioners are involved. Recently, as well, the in part as an outgrowth of that October 2008 European Commission Safe Harbor Conference I participated in, the Article 29 Working Party of the European Commission that writes opinions on the application of the European Directive on Data Protection and Privacy is looking more closely at this issue and has issued a draft document that will be explored at the June conference and is being being considered as we speak right now. Other groups as well, the International Chamber of Commerce, APAC, and other groups are similarly energized and looking for a way forward to avoid this very, very much Hobson's choice of taking medicine on one side or the other. Now, in terms of the whole e-discovery, what I call operational process of collection, processing, and particularly review, which is about 70% of the $17 billion e-discovery industry these days, there are certain best practices. One is, to the extent possible, try to do your culling and review within the same country or at least the same region, if at all possible. Sometimes it's cost prohibitive and you just have to take the risk, unfortunately. More and more organizations themselves are looking to internal resources or their preferred vendors to assist them in facilities management and other strategies to try to do some of this within the country itself, minimizing the actual transfer of personal data outside of that country, which is the biggest issue, and it's the issue that's resulted in the most significant sanctions and penalties for violations of the data protection directives and blocking statutes. My sense is that in the next several years, hopefully, we'll reach an accord with the European Commission and other countries, which is somewhat similar to the Safe Harbor certification process, but will be more narrowly focused on the needs for cross-border discovery and particularly e-discovery, so that review can be done remotely without the specter of it violating these laws simply because of a remote data connection from the U.S. to Europe or vice versa. But all that is on the table and on the agenda for discussion as we go forward. I think 2009 will be a watershed year in terms of these issues.
Yeah, you can also imagine the project management issues that come into having, you know, remote review facilities that are working in a different language with different managers would also add some challenges to a project.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's not just the character set differences. It's not just the inability to understand idioms. It's not just the lack of knowledge or awareness of the U.S. Legal system and what principles like privilege and work product and trade secret mean. It's not just those things, but it's also the either accidental or intentional transfer of data when you have, for instance, offshore review facilities looking at personal data or data that would be classified as personal data within the meaning of these regulations.
Now, you've talked a bit about working with the EU and trying to solve these problems. You mentioned earlier that there are rules all around the world that you have to be cognizant of. Is Sedona working to craft sort of suggested solutions, negotiating sort of a framework with other large trade partners, say in Asia?
Yes, actually, I'm glad you asked that. I was privileged to serve as one of the co-editors-in-chief of the Sedona Framework for Analysis of Cross-Border Discovery Conflicts, which is now in public comment version and available free of charge at www.thesedonaconference.org. And what it tries to do, it tries to lay out a series of practical considerations and, a framework for looking at these issues, everything from jurisdiction to data privacy regulations to blocking statutes to use of some of these clauses in case management orders and protective orders in the U.S. to help bolster protection on this information and thereby convince foreign jurisdictions that we really don't have a desire to violate personal freedoms or violate personal privacy. We really want to balance it with the needs to, you know, protect your own financial interests. So this framework document that Sedona has issued will be, again, in public comment draft for the next couple months. Then it will be published at or about the time of our conference in June 2009. And please ask your listeners to stay tuned as that document is relied on more and more by practitioners and courts, we hope, as they have relied upon the prior Sedona documents on electronic document retention and production in the United States.
I should mention that we have the founder and executive director of Sedona coming on a future show, Richard Brayman, to talk about the new cooperation principles, but that's a different show coming up, I think, on March 25th. But in addition to Sedona, are there any other places you'd suggest looking to learn more about international issues with electronically stored information and electronic discovery?
Yes, the Defense Research Institute is doing quite a bit in this area, and I'm actually speaking at a conference in late March in Munich that discusses these issues. So I know that's one group that's very, very active. By Googling the International Chamber of Commerce, one can find a wealth of information about their efforts to bridge this gap. And then probably the biggest single compilation of information that gives all sorts of background and detail is the EU Commission's website itself, www.europa.com. In fact, if you Google EU Privacy Directive, it will take you to the sub part of that very large website that deals with data protection and privacy. And you can see various differences between the countries, the European Union. You can see the opinions of the Article 29 Working Party on applying the Data Protection and Privacy Directive to specific types of transfer, like financial wire transfers, sharing of airline passenger lists, use of biometric devices and the like, and now coming soon, their final opinion on cross-border discovery.
Well, it sounds like this will be an interesting next year or so in this field. It almost feels like, 2005 in the United States for electronic discovery rules hopefully we'll see some further guidance. Jim, thank you very much for joining us on this show and sharing a substantial amount of information accessible to people that want to learn about this online.
Thank you, Carl, for the opportunity, and I hope this, at least in small part, helps your listeners navigate the somewhat treacherous waters of cross-border discovery at this time.
You earn bonus points for tying the title of the show into the conclusion of the show. Thanks again, Jim. It's been good, and hopefully we'll have you on more shows in the future.
Thanks, Carl.